G'day, welcome back to the Australian Tactical Medical Association podcast. This is Matt Pepper, the President of APMA, wishing you from all the association and to all the members a Happy New Year and hope you had a fantastic Christmas and break. And today we're going to dive back into the Australian Tactical Medicine Conference from last year, and we're going to hear a fantastic presentation from Professor John Maloney on blast injuries. Before we get into that, I just want to cover a couple of things that's going on with APMA. You've probably already been aware if you're on social media, but we've got the dates for the Australian Tactical Medicine Conference 2019 announced. ATMC 19 is going to be back in Brisbane at a different location, this time at the Pullman Hotel, right in the middle of the city. And it's going to be on the 19th and 20th of September. So looking forward to a huge lineup and an amazing conference again this year, with a couple more activities going on around the conference, as well as a huge lineup again of international and Australian speakers. If you haven't seen already, we've also got a grant available for an APMA member to go across to the Special Operations Medicine Scientific Assembly in Charlotte, North Carolina, from the 6th to 10th of May. We'll be providing up to $2,000 for travel and conference fees for the winner of this competition. Just get your applications in if you're keen by the 25th of January, and we'll announce that on the 1st of Feb, or by the 1st of Feb. In return for sending a member over there, we're after a publishable report on what you did at SOMSA, what you learnt, and hopefully we can try and get as much out of the scientific assembly for the rest of the members. Last year, we also had the exciting announcement of the Journal of High Threat and Osteo Medicine, the official journal of the Australian Tactical Medical Association. As a peer-reviewed online journal, it's going to be releasing publications in a rolling format, so no actual journal editions, but papers will come out as they go through the peer review process and are published. The managing editors of the journal, Tim and Alden, have a few papers already in the process, and they'll be coming out pretty soon, so keep your eyes out for that. It's a very exciting move forward for tactical high threat and osteo medicine in Australia. We're really proud that APMA's got the opportunity to support the journal and to build the evidence base and the literature within our sector. I hope you enjoy the presentation today from Professor John Maloney. Make sure you check out the show notes. It's got the PDF with all of his slides from the presentation that he gave in September last year at ATMC 18.
The next presenter this afternoon is Associate Professor John Maloney. He's a medical advisor to Ambulance Victoria. John's been the head of trauma and anaesthesia at the Alfred Hospital, Melbourne, for over a decade. He currently manages the Field Emergency Medical Officer Program, the medical support to the State Emergency Response Plan. He's recently attended both the Burke and Flinders Street incidents, the Springvale Bank explosion, and the thunderstorm asthma event. Previously, he was involved in the response to Black Saturday bushfires, for which he was awarded the National Emergency Medal. He's involved in teaching Victoria Police arson and explosive courses. He's the medical advisor to Ambulance Victoria, and he's frequently involved in pre-hospital responses. And John's topic today is on blast injuries. John, welcome to the conference, and I invite you to address.
Thanks for those words, and thank you to the organisers for giving me the opportunity to talk today. I feel a bit intimidated by, I suppose, both the quality of the presentations and the content of the people I've had before me, so hopefully we can keep that up a little bit. As most of the other speakers have said before, I don't have any financial conflicts of interest, but I'm happy to change that if someone's if someone's looking for an opportunity for the next conference. What is an explosion? And basically, it's the almost instantaneous conversion of a solid or a liquid into a volume that's about 10 to 15,000 times what it is. So I often do this talk or a similar talk with a cup of water, a glass of water, and basically it's that cup of water, a glass of water, expanding to fill this room like that. So when that happens, there's a blast wave, there's a fragmentation as my little glass explodes, and there's usually the generation of a fair amount of heat. The physicists break up explosive devices into low-order explosives and high-order explosives, really based upon how fast the explosion happens, and also sorry. And also how it happens. So the lower explosion is really like an onion where it goes off a layer at a time. It goes off a layer at a time. I might put that on too. I'll just leave it. It goes off a layer at a time, like an onion, as opposed to the higher it explodes is where the whole device goes off at once from the inside as well as from the outside. Some of the lower it explodes is, it's a bit like the Roadrunner when you're watching cartoons as a kid, and the coyote puts it along, and you can walk along beside it because it burns so slowly, some of those low-order explosives. Some of the higher explosives will be some of the stuff that's fairly familiar to many of the people in the audience, either in industry or certainly some military applications. So as the gases expand rapidly, they compress the air in front of the device, and that generates a pressure wave and a blast wave that spreads out in all directions. So my little cup here that explodes, there is a blast wave that heads off in every direction in this room, up and down. And it depends on the medium that it's in. So, for example, an underwater one, so for the military people in here, the blast wave underwater is a lot more destructive than the blast wave in the air. So for the Navy-type people or the divers, an underwater explosion transmits the force a lot more than one through the air. This is obviously a military boat, but you can see here the normal pressure air and the high pressure air and the wave or the border in between the high pressure and the low pressure. And just like all waves, they can summate in the middle here. We've got this wave and this wave. So if you go to the beach, a wave comes in, it hits the breakwater, it's going out again, and the next one comes, and all of a sudden the waves are a whole lot bigger. So when my cup explodes and the blast wave goes that way and the blast goes that way and they reflect and come back, the pressure here is a lot more than just what it would be from the device by itself in an open space. So they can be reflected, they can be focused, and people will certainly use devices to try and direct the force of a blast towards certain targets. After all this air has been pushed away, there's a negative pressure because there's something left behind, there's a gap left behind, and you get a sucking effect. And this blast wave is only seen with the high-order explosives. And here's a physics sort of demonstration. With this massive increase in pressure, which slowly drops off, becomes negative over a period of time. And I've just got the video, if you could just turn this on. So there's going to be two explosions, just here in the middle. But you can see the second one, you can see the wave coming about now on the edge, and you can again see it suck back in. So that pressure wave, that blast wave, contributes significantly to the injuries that patients have. And here's another schema where you can see the rapid increase in pressure, the destruction of a building, and then the sucking of stuff back in. So speaking of destruction of building, you can look at the amount of force in PSIs, and they're really not much if you think about how much air you put in your car tyre, to break a window or to overturn even a loaded rail train is 7 PSI. And when we come back, actually we'll get it to the next page, about the pressures that people can sustain. So we start talking about rupturing tympanic membranes at 5 PSI, which is not much less than the pressure that you can use to overturn a train. So people are reasonably robust from a physics point of view for the amount of pressure that they'll sustain. Interestingly, we used to think that tympanic membrane rupture or the lack of a tympanic membrane rupture meant you hadn't been exposed to a lot of pressure because I thought it would rupture. Whereas we don't think that necessarily now because of maybe the way it bounces around and you can still get lung injury without necessarily having a perforated eardrum. The FBI and a lot of the law enforcement agencies around the world have come up with diagrams basically to demonstrate how much explosive you can stick into various devices and where you should be as a first responder or as a member of the community when you might be exposed to one of these. And part of this is recognising here that if you're in a building inside this space, then you're still vulnerable from the building collapsing because of the amount of force that it doesn't actually take to damage a building significantly. And then the outer radius is things like shrapnel flying and broken glass from the pressure breaking windows up to a couple of kilometres away. might just skip that one. So when my glass of explosive blows up, my glass is going to fragment and there'll be a whole lot of little bits of glass going flying around the room, damaging you all. Now, I'm not a very nice person and I'm a bit iron deficient, so I've got a few nuts and bolts inside my glass of water and they're going to go flying as well and cause injury. And so many of the terrorists around the world are putting things like nuts and bolts, which they buy at Bunnings or similar. So they're not nice, clean, surgically implantable screws that are sterile. They're, you know, rusty and full of bugs and things. They generate a lot of heat. The lower explosives burn longer. The higher explosives burn hotter. And then there's the secondary hazards from the device. So I can't see because there's a whole lot of bright lights in my face, but there's... there'll be some power lines in here. This is a reasonably new building, so there's probably not any asbestos. The carpet's probably all synthetic, and so it'll generate a whole lot of chemicals when it burns, as are the seats. There's probably some radioactive stuff in the smoke detectors. So there's a whole lot of things that in the environment that then the people involved in the incident can get exposed to as well. The consequences depend on a whole lot of things, such as what the device is made of, how well it was made, the environment that it was in, how far from the device people are, whether there's anything in between them or not, and other environmental hazards. And we describe the injuries in four groups. So the first group are those related directly to the blast injury. The second, due to things being thrown at you. The third is when you get thrown at something, so you get pushed against the door, pushed down the stairs. And the fourth is everything else. So it's the burns, it's the smoke inhalation, it's making your asthma worse, it's making your chest pain worse as you run away. All of those fit into the fourth category. So the primary blast injuries are related to the pressure wave. As I said, it's only from higher explosives. And it can be very disruptive to the human body. This is a photo from Israel, but the same thing happened to the original Bali bomber in Paddy's Bar. He managed to decapitate himself when his device in his backpack went off. The injuries that the patients get are primarily parts of the body where there's gas already. So as the pressure wave happens, bits of the body that contain gas expand and change at different rates in different ways. So for those of you who flew here today or yesterday or the day before, I'm sure there was a three-year-old sitting behind you. And when they took off and when they landed, their ears hurt because they were unable to quickly equilibrate the pressure across their eardrum as the cabin pressure changed. Now imagine that pressure change is about 1,000 to 10,000 times more and it happens like that, not over the 5 or 10 or 20 minutes to get from the... take off to cruising altitude. So then imagine that much force that the kid's got, the three-year-old with his blocked ear and the pain that that's causing, and then how much more likely the same, that increased pressure over that much reduced time is going to significantly damage their eardrum. The same thing happens in our lungs, which obviously contain air, but they can expand at different rates and tear the tissues, and in our gut. And we can also have damage to our brain as well. This is a classic X-ray, and you can see this is meant to be black, but it basically says there's a whole lot of fluid, which in this case would be blood, inside the air-containing spaces, which obviously makes the lungs very stiff and hard to transmit, to absorb oxygen. So for those of you who've seen this, I gather most of you have been in sort of animal labs at least. These are meant to be nice, pink, fluffy things that would float on water. These are really thick, wet sponges that will sink. So if you think about a normal dry sponge, when you squash it and let go, it just expands again. And that's what your lungs are like. When your lungs are full of blood, you can't squash them and they don't come back up again. So just imagine the work that your body's got to do to fill that up with oxygen and then expel it again. So they can present with a whole lot of symptoms. Some of these may not appear straight away. So there is a risk that some of these patients are going to go home thinking that they're not injured, or we'll send them to a low acuity hospital thinking they're not really injured, and then they develop some of these signs and symptoms later. I might just keep moving. So these are, again, some of the signs and symptoms. So for, our pre-hospital people, if we're seeing patients with some of these signs, then maybe we need to be thinking, has this patient had a significant blast injury to their lung. Someone before in the nutrition bit was talking about just repetitive concussion. And so you can certainly lose consciousness from the primary blast wave. It really is just a big fist in the head. But you can also get, a whole lot of mild neurological symptoms which are non-specific. And maybe it's going to be hard to work out whether it's from the trauma of the blast or whether it's just a response, post-traumatic stress or similar. We've already talked about the eardrums. And basically, you just get a little hole in the drum, which may or may not be permanent. And in Oklahoma, which we'll come back to later, there was a 35% incidence of hearing loss after that event. The abdomen's the same. Your gut contains air, more or less, depending on what you had for lunch. But because of that, with the blast wave, it can shear. And so the tissues, one bit gets pulled this way, one gets pulled that way. And so you can see here there's some bleeding into the wall of the intestine. And that might perforate later, like today, tomorrow, next day. So they can present with signs and symptoms either now or again a few little bit down the line. You can just see some small holes in the bowel in there. The effect on the body depends very much on how the body is oriented to the blast wave. So I've got three pictures with different orientations. So here's the blast wave coming from here. And in this one, the patient or the victim is lying either with their feet or their head towards the device. And these are different types of injuries. But I'll just get you to pick the top one, which I can't actually remember what it says. So that's a 1% survival. So if you're lying like this and you get 4,000, you've got a 1% chance. If you're at right angles, that 1% now drops down to 1,000. And if you're lying against a wall, it drops down to 500. So the ability of the body to tolerate the blast wave really depends on their orientation to the blast wave when it is given to the patient. And that's relevant when you look at the Israeli experience, who unfortunately have really probably the most experience with this in the civilian population. And they did a study looking at events over this 3 or 4 year period. Their mortality, depending on whether it was in an open space, a semi-confined space, or a confined space such as a bus, significantly impacted on the mortality of the patient. And so the terrorists would, you know, you put it in a bus, and one of the suggestions was they actually do it in winter and summer because they have the air conditioning on, the windows closed, so it's an even more confined space rather than autumn and spring where the weather's nice and they drive around with the windows open. So again, from the same studies, open space versus enclosed space, the mortality is nearly 5 times as much. Injury severity score is a measure of severe trauma, so they offered as the busiest trauma centre in Australia, it's about 4 of these a day. But again, you're twice as likely in an enclosed space to have that severe trauma. You're twice as likely to have multiple injuries. You're more likely to need surgery, and you're twice as likely to need to go to ICU. So if you're going to make a bomb, you only got a little bit of money, you'd certainly intend to do it into an enclosed space rather than a non-enclosed space. So I've got 2 photos now of 2 female suicide bombers in Israel about 4 or 5 months apart. One was in an enclosed space. One was in an open space. I don't know that they had the same device, but given how close they were, it's probably not unreasonable to suspect that they were similar devices at least. So this one was in a restaurant, killed 21 people and wounded 60. And this one was in an open air market and killed 2. So the difference in the mortality from being inside to outside is significant. So if you're going to be a bomb maker, you're going to want to set your device off in an enclosed space if you can possibly get there. So I suppose from the police point of view, we can actually keep the device out of the place. And one of the Israeli ones, not too long ago, the security guy at the door of the restaurant actually died, but he stopped the perpetrator getting inside, which is what he or she was planning to do, to get into the restaurant and detonate the device. So died himself, but saved a lot of other people who were going to die from inside. I might just skip that one as well. If they actually get to hospital, their chance of survival is significant. Like, their mortality rate in Israel is 2% if they actually get to hospital. So again, from how do we manage this in the pre-hospital space from all of the people that are here to actually get that person to hospital alive, they are likely to stay alive. So that's primary blast injury, which is really related to the pressure wave. The second things that happen is when things get thrown at you. And so, as I said before, the terrorists are now sticking nuts and bolts and things into their devices, which become flying projectiles. This is a photo from Centennial Park in Atlanta for the bombing during the Olympics. And this is the perpetrator who basically set up a pipe bomb with three pipes. He had a, where is it in here? He'd actually set up a steel plate as a directional device to try and get all of the force to go in one direction. Someone had moved his backpack a little bit, so it didn't quite work the way he wanted it to do. And at the time, it was the biggest pipe bomb that had in the US. So it was open air. There were two deaths, one of which we'll come back to. The other one was apparently a reporter who got ischemic chest pain and died. I'm not sure whether he or she was running towards or away from the incident. But again, a whole lot of injured people. And he was a... This is this is an example of a pipe bomb. And so you can see what happens as the device inside expands. This metal just gets thinner and thinner, a bit like if you're blowing up a balloon, the plastic just gets smaller and smaller. But these become razor-sharp bits of metal that then become a projectile. And here's an example of a pipe bomb that's about 15 centimetres with some explosive gel inside. And this, I think that is the car that we ended up blowing up, but that's like a before photo and that's an after photo. So a pipe bomb that size placed inside a car will do that much damage. This is a lady that died in Atlanta, Alicia Hawthorne, and she died from one nail to her head. So 2 inches further forward, backwards, upwards or downwards, she probably would have survived. But the fact that he put the nail in there meant that she died. And again, as I was saying, he was a repeat offender. He targeted a lot of gay and lesbian nightclubs and abortion clinics. And so again, one of them was said, you know, someone just turned up and they had a nail sticking out of their forearm as they turned up into the pub. He was using secondary devices. So again, for us as first responders, this is where they were setting up a command post and this is where he had his second device. So if that was a pipe bomb and you put your car on top of it, it might make a little bit of a dent. And as I said, he got caught after this one. I don't know what happened to him after that. So the secondary injuries are more common to the bigger parts of the body. So civilians don't have body armour. Our torso is the biggest bit. So that's when things come flying at us, that's where it's likely to hit us. So head, neck, chest, abdomen, extremities. We can get amputations of limbs if there's enough force. And as I said before, these foreign bodies, they're not military-grade weapons. They're not bullets that are designed to go and you know, go straight through and out the other side. These are nuts and bolts that aren't aerodynamic. And sometimes they might only be a small sign that they've actually gone in. They're going to be dirty. So these are the sorts of things that they're using. So this is from a Tel Aviv nightclub with nuts and bolts. And if you think about a victim and where this goes, does it go into her abdomen at all? And if it goes into abdomen, does it go through the femoral artery, bowel, bladder, all of the above? One of these. Heart, lung, aorta, liver, kidney. So to actually try and sort all of that out, because these, again, aren't aerodynamic. They're just going through and they're tumbling and they're going like this and they're going to bounce off bones and they're just going to go wherever. So our ability to clinically assess a patient, so we need a very high index of suspicion that there's going to be multiple parts of this body that is going to be injured. And you can just see again, each one of those is infected or will become infected if we don't look after it. And certainly, as we said before, the shrapnel can fracture bones. And these can happen a long way away. So in Oklahoma, 29% of the eye injuries are more than 100 metres from the blast. So you come back to that drawing we had before, sort of the FBI one with the sort of zones of safety and how far away you need to be. And in Cobar Towers, 88% of the patients were hurt by flying glass. In Nairobi, there were people being injured by glass 2 kilometres away. Boston, again, shrapnel. This is a pressure cooker. At the time that Boston happened, you could buy that pressure cooker in Kmart in Melbourne for about $20. You can't buy firecrackers legally in Victoria, but I'm sure from Canberra on a mail order, you could probably get enough to fill that up for $20, and you go to Bunnings and buy $20 of nuts and bolts, and you just need a detonation device and you've got your device. Just place it in the community. So again, if you think about how big that was and how far away you might need to be to not get injured. And I think it's reasonable to think about these numbers when we're things like setting up our warm zones and our hot zones and where we're going to stage. And this, I can see people saying those, this is readily available on a whole lot of web pages because a whole lot of different organisations around the world have basically got the same device, sorry, the same idea. Some of them are metric and some of them are imperial measurements. So primary is the blast injury. Secondary is things being thrown at you. The thing about secondary ones is you can hide behind something. So if my device goes off down here, it's got to go through that to get to you. Whereas the primary ones can go around corners. So basically anyone in this room is potentially a victim of a blast injury from the blast wave if I can make the blast wave big enough. But the people in the back row are pretty unlikely to get a direct shrapnel wound. The tertiary ones are when you get thrown. So you get pushed. And this is really the same as being pissed and falling down the stairs. It's just blunt trauma from a fall. And so the treatment of that is really the same as how we would treat, as paramedics or other first responders, how we would treat anyone who basically fell over or fell from a height. And they get the same sorts of injuries. And they really just follow the same protocols. I'll just skip that. And then quaternary is everything else. So it's the asthma, it's the chest pain, it's the burns, it's the smoke inhalation. Some people would put the psychological and psychiatric injuries into that space as well. And so we talked about the reporter in Atlanta who got chest pain and died as a result of that event. And so you could presumably say that that was a quaternary injury. Burns are significant. This is a photo from the Russell Street bombing in 1986. So the building you can see in the background was the Melbourne City Court. Over this side of the road was a police station, and there was a device in a car. And so at lunchtime, when all of the cops came out of the courtroom, the device detonated, there was a significant fire, and Angela Taylor unfortunately died at the Royal Melbourne about a week or two later. So one of the things is we talked very early on about the blast injury and what it does to a building and how little force it actually needed to overturn a train and how robust the body is. So I can be standing next to a building that gets blown up and survive until the building lands on top of me. And so people have used that for injuries as well. So ANFO is one of the devices, been used significantly in a number of events around the world. It's easy to make, is one of our trainees mixing some up with the bomb squad on one of their courses. And that's what happened with a car. After that, that's enough to put in a backpack. Reed Barley one. 30 kilos of ANFO. Does that to a car? Imagine what it does in a nightclub. This is Oklahoma. That was a truck full of ANFO. And that's what it did to a 7-story building. One of the things about Oklahoma was they were one of the first ones. There was a couple from the IRA bombings in Northern Ireland, which I looked at, and the Birmingham 6 bombings, where they actually looked at the injury patterns as well. But this is one of the first studies where they actually looked at where people were when the device went off and what their injury patterns were. And so you can see some of these ones up here. Presumably some of those fell out the front. One of the things I think as first responders we need to think about, and people spoke earlier about, you know, how much we can use tourniquets and stuff on pediatrics, the psychology of this is probably immeasurable. And how are we as first responders going to deal with that? And part of it, I think, is actually being aware that we're going to have to face that. And other people have spoken about sort of stress inoculation and stuff. But I think even just an awareness that that might be what's going to happen, that might be what I'm going to see, makes you probably a little bit more able to deal with that when you have to deal with it. How long have I got? 2 minutes. So we can break bombings down into a number of areas. So the immediate structural collapse, crush injuries, high fracture rates, and they're going to inhale stuff. Confined space bombings, we're going to have blast injuries. And open air bombings, if they basically survive, they're going to survive because of the way that they're going to get hurt. So when we're being dispatched to a job, even before we even know what's happened, we get some idea about the sorts of injuries that we're likely to see on the patients when we get there based on whether it was inside and the building's collapsed, inside the building's intact, or it's outside. So in summary, we've got primary injuries, secondary injuries, tertiary injuries, and quaternary injuries. The blast wave, things being thrown, us being thrown, and everything else. And I was going to talk quickly about the dirty bombs, but I didn't get there. So I will stop with that.
Pretty interesting topic. Do we have any questions? Thanks very much, John.
That's right.
Another great presentation that really ties in a number of the presentations we've had over the last couple of days. John's presentation for me really highlights the impact that unconventional threats are having, whether it's first responders in a civilian or domestic setting or overseas. And if you reflect back on Mark's presentation this morning about knowing what those threats that are out there and understanding those threats and how to protect yourself as first responders, but also understanding the types of injuries that you're going to potentially treat when you get on the scene. And you only have to look at what we're facing in some of those threats in the pictures and what we've seen overseas with the enemy understanding what our TTPs are and then starting to change their own by setting up a small primary charge and then waiting, knowing that we're stopping 100 metres short and then setting up the secondary charge, which is, you know, 10 times bigger at where we stop our vehicles, or ISIS using drones in swarms carrying hand grenades to a great effect. You know, the unconventional threats that are out there are just growing in number and lethality, and I think that presentation really highlights the impact of that. So thanks very much, John. That was a great presentation.